This podcast has been generously sponsored by Michael and Daniela Rader in honor of their mother Barbara's 75th birthday.
Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayera. This week, Judy Klitzner discusses Vayera. Judy Klitzner is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Judy Klitzner.
Thank you, Larry. I want to talk about Parshat Vayera. And as always, when I approach any passage in the biblical text, I like to start with the kushia, with a firm belief that the kushia, the difficulty, is the beginning point of all commentary. As it was my great privilege to learn with Professor Nechama Leibovitz of blessed memory, who taught me and thousands of others that what the main enterprise of the commentators is to look closely into the verses and ask what is difficult in those verses. And from there flow all efforts at resolution, and that's where all the good stuff happens. What exactly is meant by a kushia, a difficulty, as opposed to a simple question? A question is posed to, when we want information. What time is it? What color is a piece of clothing? A kushia is something else. A kushia implies a contradiction between that which we expect to find and that which we find instead. Kushiot can be grammatical, syntactical, logical, theological. Why are things this way? We expected it to be otherwise. And in fact, when we look at the very first verse of the Torah, the very first word of the Torah, we notice that word itself presents a tremendous kushia. Bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, right? At first glance, what could be simpler than that? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But when we look more closely, we notice that the first word is actually problematic, because bereshit, strictly speaking, does not mean in the beginning. It means in the beginning of. This is called smichut, where it's a connective form, bereshit. How do we make sense of this? In the beginning of what? God created the heavens and the earth. That's the problem. From there, this gives the substance. This gives the pool from which all the commentators draw. How now will we resolve this issue? So as many commentators there are, that's usually how many possible responses there are. Some commentators will say, well, in the beginning of, it's written in an elliptical manner. There's something that's missing, but the intelligent reader can fill in that which is heavily implied. What's missing? In the beginning of time, in the beginning of it all, in the beginning of the world, God created the heavens and the earth. That's one possibility. The Midrash goes in a different direction. And just to give you an example of one comment in the Midrash that's brought by Rashi, he says, what is bereshit? It actually doesn't mean in the beginning at all. It means be, with, reshit. Reshit, with the word reshit, with the concept of reshit. Reshit is code for Torah. As we all know, in the book of Mishle, of Proverbs, the Torah is referred to as reshit darko, the beginning of God's path. And so when we refer to the Torah, we can call it reshit. But if we understand it in this midrashic manner, bereshit bara Elohim et hashamayim v'et haaretz, then means with Torah, as a basis, as a foundation, God created the heavens and the earth. If we're looking for something that is more pshat-oriented, more in line with a simple, plain interpretation of the text, Rashi offers us another view, which is another possibility, which is to change the vocalization of the word bara. Instead of saying bereshit bara, in the beginning of God created, we must read this bereshit biro. In the beginning of God's creation of the heavens and the earth, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And in fact, this is the approach that many translators take. As we all know, translations are all interpretations. Sometimes, right, translations we know can be very helpful, but they can also be a hindrance. Because what translators do is to note the difficulties on their own and solve them for us. And the downside to that is that when we read only the translation, we never take note of the initially beautifully constructed, artfully constructed, problematic nature of the verse. One translation that is notably different than that is the Everett Fox translation into English, where there are translations that often are very awkward in English, but actually retain the problematic nature of the original Hebrew. So, with all that as background, we turn to our parasha, the 18th chapter of the book of Bereshit, the beginning of Parashat Vayera. And I want to read the first two verses closely with an eye toward looking for the problems, the kushiyot. It is very greatly recommended that everyone out there listen to this with a chumash in hand, not if you're driving. And I think that gives new meaning to the notion of texting while driving. We should never do that. So, let's look at the first two verses. Vayera elav Hashem be'elone mamre. Literally, he appeared to him. All right, sorry. God appeared to him in elone mamre, terebinths of mamre. V'hu yoshev petach ha'ohel kechom hayom. He is sitting at the entrance to the tent in the heat of the day. Next verse. Vayisa enav vayar. He lifted his eyes and he saw. V'hine shalosha anashim nitzavim alav. There are three men standing upon him. Vayar, vayarotz likratam. He saw and he ran to greet them. Mipetach ha'ohel, from the entrance to the tent. Vayishtachu arza, and he bent down. Okay. Now, in an ideal world, I would pause here and ask all of my learned and intelligent readers and students to respond. What is it that's problematic in this text? So I'll give you a second to think about that. And I will assume that some of you are suggesting the following. First of all, if we are beginning a new chapter, a new story, a new parasha, why begin with a pronoun? Vayera elav. Hashem. God appeared. What would we expect here? If it's a new story, we should have the proper name. God appeared to Avraham. And then continue. What is it? In fact, the story that immediately precedes this at the end of Parashat Lech Lecha is the story of the Brit Milah of Avraham and his household, the circumcision of Avraham and his household. And we'll leave that as background. But it seems initially odd that a new story, a new section, a new Torah portion should begin with a pronoun and not with a proper name. In addition, a second very, very large problem with this is that in verse 1, God appears, Vayera Elav Hashem. It seems with great ceremony, there's this appearance, there's this visitation. What do we expect to come in the next verse? Should be some content. God should say something. God should do something. But instead, Vayisa Eina Vayar, the text goes off in a different direction completely. He, Abraham, lifted his eyes and he saw three men and he goes running off in the direction of the men. What happens to God? What happens to that whole visit? It seems that is completely dropped as the story unfolds. And we can add to that, how could it be that Avraham, how it seems just a little impolite, to put it nicely, of Avraham to run toward the men. He gets this visit by none other than God, and God sees somebody, other people in the distance, and he just takes leave of God and runs off toward the people. With all of those difficulties in mind, Rashi makes the famous comment, what is happening here in this visit? Rashi says, Livaker et hachole. Why is God coming to visit? To visit the sick. Why is Avraham sick? Rashi continues, citing Rabbi Chama Bar Chanina, Yom Shlishi Lemilato Haya, Uva HaKadosh Baruch Hu V'Sha'al Bishlomo. It's the third day after Avraham's circumcision, when we all know that. Now, I don't know it, but some people tell me that it is the most painful day. And God comes and asks how Avraham is doing. Okay, this is a very nice comment to make. God is so concerned about Avraham that God goes out of his way to visit Avraham after his surgery. But I would like to suggest that Rashi is doing much more than simply making a nice, pleasant comment. Rashi is responding to the difficulties in the text. First of all, why begin a new story with pronouns? Well, if we read this the way that Rashi does, Vayera Elav Hashem, God appears to him, this is actually a continuation of the story that precedes it, of the story of Avraham's circumcision. So that these two stories are integrally connected through the use of this pronoun. In terms of the second problem, why is there no content that is recorded? What is the purpose of God's visit? Rashi fills in that piece of information as well by saying God comes just to visit. No agenda. God is just paying a friendly call to someone who is beloved to him, and so he just drops by. I have to say I had the privilege of learning this passage several times with Nechama Leibovitz, and she was particularly fond of this comment in Rashi and the notion behind it that sometimes it's really nice to drop by to see a person, to see a loved one without any agenda. I came by just to see you, just to see how you're doing. That gives a whole new feeling to the visit when there's nothing else to it. So Rashi's view accounts for some, but not all of the anomalies in the text. What remains unanswered is, if God has visited Avraham, how could Avraham just take leave of God and run toward these visitors? And it also, Rashi's view also creates a new, yet related difficulty, which is why would God compete with himself, right? If God first arrives in person, why would God interrupt that visit by sending three divine messengers? Why separate God's visit into these two parts? So I would suggest that these unanswered questions might prompt us to look at other attempts by other commentators at resolution of our difficulties. And I would like to look at a very well-studied comment by Rashbam, who also happened to have been Rashi's grandson. And Rashbam, on the same words, suggests a different structural read of our verse. Vayera elav Hashem be'elonei mamre. God appeared to Avraham, as he was sitting at the entrance to the tent in the heat of the day. And Rashbam adds one very significant word, which is he'ach. How? How did God do this? Shlosha anashim shayu malachim. God appears to them in the guise of these three men, these three messengers. And in fact, some translators over the centuries have agreed with this. There are some that even go as far as to say God appeared to Abraham in the heat of the day. Namely, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw three men. Okay, so the first verse is a kind of grand introduction, and what follows is a detailing of that introduction. How did God appear to Abraham? God appeared through the agency of these three people. There's only one visit, and that is by God, who is manifest in the form of three men. Okay, now Rashbam's suggestion solves some of our problems, right? The visit by God in verse 1 has no content because it's just an introduction to the visit of the three men. God visited, and this is how it happened. In his view, if we read things Rashbam's way, Avraham doesn't run away from God at all. This is how the visit went from beginning to end. And in addition, God doesn't compete with himself because it's all one account of one divine visit. And I think that Rashbam's view is beneficial in understanding some verses later in this same chapter. And if we look in chapter 18 at verse 15, where God is talking, verse 15 is where God responds to Sarah's laughter. God rebukes and says, you laughed. The next verse, there's this abrupt shift between God speaking to the men. In verse 16, the men then get up and look over Sodom. So there's a shift from God to the men. And then in the next verse, right back to God again. Vashem Amar in verse 17. And God is speaking, will I hide from Avraham all that I'm about to do? So there are these constant sudden shifts between God and the three men that take place throughout the chapter that could be considered quite confusing. But Rashbam's suggestion actually helps make sense of this, that it's all the same thing. And the shifting simply gives us a different view of that godly event. Is it God? Is it the people? Well, actually, they're all one and the same. Okay, if we accept Rashbam's reading, if this is the best we're going to do, I think one very large remaining problem with all of this is, why risk confusing the reader by calling these visitors both men and God? Why not just call them angels? And that, in fact, is a term that's employed in the next chapter when two of God's messengers go to Lot. They're called malachim, angels. So I would like to suggest the following. Here's a theory of mine, and that is that there is a purposeful blurring in the identity of these visitors. Are they God? Are they human? And I think that that blurring hints at a deep and interconnected relationship between the spheres of the human and divine. In a sense, in this chapter, the classic dichotomy of an encounter that is between human beings and God, ben adam la makom, and an encounter between human beings among themselves, ben adam la chaveiro, that dichotomy begins to break down. Where in a very subtle way, the text is hinting at us that when we care for another person, that is a kind of interaction with the divine. When Avraham, or to put it simply, when Avraham looks into the faces of these three visitors, in his view, he is actually, in some sense, looking into the face of God. Along similar lines, the 20th century French Jewish philosopher Levinas tells us that there can be no knowledge of God that is separated from relationship with men. The other, he says, is the very locus of metaphysical truth and is indispensable for my relationship with God. In Levinas's view, in his writings, the path to the divine-human relationship is paved with justice, with tzedakah, this very evocative term, tzedakah, which I would like to understand as looking deeply into the face of the other and acting in all ways, through justice, through righteousness, through chesed, in ways to help that other person. When we encounter the other in this way, we are in essence successfully encountering the face of God. And to get back to the text of our parasha, I think we might argue that the entire relationship between Avraham and God is predicated on Avraham's ability to see the face of God in every human being. And to get back to the text, if we look at verse 19, we have the response to a great riddle that has been haunting us since we first met Avraham back in chapter 12. When we first met Avraham, God, one fine day, God says to Avraham, Lech lecha, get going, I pick you. But there's no explanation as to why, of all people, God has created that relationship with Avraham. We have to wait for six long chapters until we get to that. And that is in our chapter, chapter 18, where God, who's about to destroy the wicked people of Sodom, says, I better disclose my intentions to Avraham. After all, I have picked him out from all the people. Ki yida'ativ, in verse 19, I've elected him, I've singled him out. Lima'an asher yitzaveh et banav ve'et beito acharav, v'shamru derech Hashem lasot tzedakah u'mishpat. I've singled him out in order that he will command his children and his household after him to keep the path of God, to do tzedakah u'mishpat. Justice, righteousness, these terms have many possible nuances. But it's, I think the outstanding piece here, several things. First of all, the fact that God chooses the word lima'an, which is very different than the Hebrew word that would signify something that has already happened. God chooses Avraham not biglal, not because of something Avraham has done. He has not because he has distinguished himself throughout his life, but lima'an, in order. There is this solemn task that God is giving Avraham. Take on this burden, take on this responsibility, this divine task of purveying justice, goodness throughout the world. And this, tzedakah u'mishpat, significantly is defined by this verse as derech Hashem. This is the path of God. This is actually quite astounding when you think about it. God doesn't say that the path of God is defined by eating glatt kosher food or by upholding great stringencies in Shabbat observance. But if you've got to pare down the message to one term, one idea, it is purveying, by interacting with others, with out of empathy, out of righteousness, out of morality, out of chesed. And that is what it earns Avraham his place as God's chosen prophet. I think this verse makes it especially jarring that almost immediately after God states that the reasons for choosing Avraham, tzedakah u'mishpat, almost immediately the scene shifts to this city of Sodom, a society that is the very symbol of the antithesis of tzedakah u'mishpat. And in fact, in verse 20, God says, Za'akat Sodom va'amora ki rabba. What defines this society is that it brings out a za'aka, a cry, an outcry from the needy, from the downtrodden. The next verse talks about a tsa'aka, and these two words are often used interchangeably and mean essentially the same thing. A cry that almost a spontaneous cry that comes from people who are being treated badly. This term, I think, tsa'aka, plays on the term tzedakah. There's a kind of sound play that's going on, word play that's going on. And if you think that sounds fanciful, there is actually a verse in the book of Isaiah that draws that word play and tells us that when God describes the unjust society that the Israelites have created, God says, there's a hope for justice, but we don't get it. There's a hope for tzedakah, vihine tzaakah. Instead of tzedakah, what we have is this terrible, terrible outcry from the people who are being oppressed. So here we have this terrible, terrible society, Sodom, that is the very essence of tzedakah. And Avraham steps up and says, and basically demonstrates why it is that God is so correct in choosing him. If he is supposed to pervade tzedakah, he begins immediately by calling on God to apply God's own principles of tzedakah to this very unworthy city. Basically, he says to God, you chose me to pervade tzedakah and mishpat in the world. Let me begin by challenging you. Where is your tzedakah? And in verse 23, Avraham says to God, Ha'af tispe tzadik im rasha. God, are you going to confuse the tzadik, right? Again, from that same root of tzedakah, with the evil person. And then he goes on to say, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'ase mishpat. You're interested in tzedakah. Where is your tzedakah? You're interested in mishpat. God, where is your mishpat? In Avraham's lengthy, and I would say chutzpah-filled bargaining session with God, he invokes the word tzedek and variations of it no fewer than 7 times, and the word mishpat twice. This text offers us, in grand literary style, an affirmation from the mouth of Avraham that God was right for appointing him as the purveyor of tzedakah. And as the master of tzedakah o mishpat, Avraham is so qualified that he now turns to God and calls on God to live up to those highest standards. And in promoting tzedakah o mishpat, Avraham is willing to take on God in order to search for the face of God in every human being, even people who by all apparent standards seem to be unworthy. I think all in all, chapter 18 is wonderfully symmetrical. There is this unified theme of Avraham's practice of tzedakah u'mishpat, this compassionate gaze into the faces of others, seeing God's image and helping them in the most extreme ways. The chapter's 2 bookends, first Avraham's lavish ministrations to his guests at the chapter's opening, and then at the end, his impassioned appeal on behalf of the sinners of Sodom, all of that, I think, join together to prove the correctness of the chapter's middle, which is God's call to Avraham. I have singled him out. Lima'an asher yitzaveh et banav et beito acharav v'shamru derech Hashem la'asot tzedakah u'mishpat. God chooses him for that, and Avraham demonstrates it from beginning to end in this chapter. God's choice of Avraham in the end was absolutely correct. He and is the most appropriate progenitor of this nation that is charged to see the face of God in every human being. This is the core of our system. This is its hope. This is its challenge. And I would just add that when life sometimes seems devoid of justice, righteousness, godliness, we're called upon to make demands of our greater demands, ever-increasing demands of ourselves, of each other, and sometimes even of God in order to make things better. So as not to be guilty of a selective reading of cherry picking, let me sound the alarm that everything we just saw is about to be challenged and even overturned at the parasha's end. The story of the Akedah defies all known principles of tzedakah u'mishpat and poses questions about the profound absence of tzedakah in God's actual world. But, oh gosh, look at the time. I guess that's for another podcast.
Thank you, Judy. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.